Good morning, everyone.
Good
morning. To those of you I haven't met, I'm Deborah Gorman-Smith. I'm the Dean of the School of Social Service Administration, or SSA, as we say, because that's much easier to say than School of Social Service Administration. And I'm extremely pleased to welcome everyone joining us today, both here in our lobby and also on the live stream. This morning's event is part of an ongoing partnership between the University of Chicago Office of Civic Engagement and the City Club of Chicago. SSA is honored to be part of this partnership, which brings committed community stakeholders to the table to share ideas on pressing social issues facing our city. Thanks in particular to our new friends at the City Club of Chicago, including members of the board and staff who are here, as well as our colleagues at the Office of Civic Engagement, including Derek Douglas, Susanna Vasquez, and Wendy Williams. At SSA, we tackle tough problems like economic opportunity and examine how race, power, and privilege impact our communities. These are matters that concern us deeply at SSA and why we have a keen interest in hosting this morning's conversation. We know that with the right mix of leadership, vision, and research, that we can transform communities and entire cities. And success is possible when leaders, policymakers, and committed communities work together to make systemic change. We've been especially encouraged by the strategic efforts initiated by City Clerk Anna Valencia. As many of you know, this past December, Kirk Valencia launched the Fines, Fees, and Access Collaborative, and over a six-month period, this working group has been reviewing municipal collection practices in the city with the explicit goal of reducing the burden of fines and fees on low-income residents, particularly on the south and west side. At the clerk's invitation, SSA has been a partner to this work, lending the expertise and talent of UChicago faculty and students to help solve these pressing challenges. SSA faculty and student researchers also are partnering with the clerk on New City Key ID Initiative, which is expanding access and helping to provide services to Chicago's most vulnerable and marginalized citizens. SSA is honored to be a partner in the clerk's office and to the city in these efforts, working collaboratively with city officials, community organizations, and civic leaders to develop solutions that will benefit more city residents. This morning is an opportunity to learn how policymakers, community activists, philanthropic leaders, and universities like UChicago are working together to reduce income inequality in Chicago and open doors to more communities and families. We have much to share and learn from one another, and I want to thank you again for joining us here this morning. It's now my honor to introduce our moderator, Anna Valencia, City Clerk of Chicago. As City Clerk of Chicago, Ms. Valencia oversees one of the largest offices in the city. She's made it a priority to find innovative and creative ways to bring services to more residents and to work collaboratively with private and public sectors. She was the second woman and first Latina to run Mayor Emanuel's Legislative Council and Government Affairs Office, where she stabilized funds to assist immigrants and refugees at risk of deportation. And she was singled out, this one of my favorite things, as an emerging power player by Chicago Magazine. Please join me and welcome Anna Valencia.
Good morning. What an exciting day. Thank you so much for being here today to help us celebrate this exciting report and this conversation. I want to welcome all of you today to advancing our economic equity for all those who call Chicago home. I want to start off first thanking the University of Chicago for hosting us today alongside with the City Club of Chicago. I know City Club here, if you're here from City Club or University of Chicago, please wave or stand to be recognized. We can clap for them. It's institutions like these that help support and facilitate important conversations like we're having today and gives us a true platform. So thank you. But before we dive into the conversation, I want to share some exciting news with you today. 6 months ago, we launched the Chicago Fines, Fees, and Access Collaborative, bringing together city departments, community advocates, academic institutions, including the University of Chicago and Loyola University, elected officials, and residents together to review the city's ticketing and fee practices. We set forth to create a set of inclusive recommendations that takes into account the various circumstances of residents who are impacted by these policies. Policies that negatively impacted people in our communities every single day. I want to tell you a quick story about one man that sticks out in particular. We were on the west side at a town hall, and there was a gentleman with his wife and had five children. And he had told me that he had $5,000 in city sticker debt. And he needed $2,500 half down for a payment to get on a payment plan. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't actually have a lot of $2,500 just sitting around. And if I did, I probably wouldn't give it to the city of Chicago. But what touched me about this is that we often tell people in our communities, and I even believe this growing up, that if you work hard and you do right and you have a good job, he has a CTA bus driver, that your family can succeed. And what happened with his debt amounting, we talk about the debt spiral, he lost his job and lost his ability to provide for his family. So what we're really doing is we're putting barriers in front of families when in government we should be removing these barriers. So this story in particular, and many others like it, is what drives me every single day, and I know that drives the collaborative to do this meaningful work. We wanted to create immediate as well as lasting transformational change to the current systems, to strike the right balance between equitable practices and compliance. But before I go into these recommendations, I want to recognize and thank the community groups and advocates, some which are here in the audience today, who they've been advocating for this work for so many years and deserve to be recognized. They are the reasons that we are here today, and they were pushing me and my team every single day to do everything that we could. Today is truly your day. So please stand when I name you if you are here in the audience today. Remain standing and hold your applause to applaud everyone at the end. Chicago Jobs Council, Community Organization and Family Issues, COFI and Power PAC, the Fines and Fees Justice Center, the Financial Justice Project San Francisco, Heartland Alliance, Loyola Chicago Center for Urban Research and Learning, Sargent Shriver National Center on Poverty Law, University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration, the Woodstock Institute. It is truly their dedication and commitment to this work that has helped us get to where we are today. Thank you. Now I'm going to embarrass my team. This work would not be done without an amazing team. And I always say I have the best team in baseball. I don't even like baseball, but I have the best team in baseball because without this, it's just a vision. Without a report with words, it's just words. We have the truly best team that are executors and do the work every single day without being recognized. And so I'd like for if you work in the Office of City Clerk or have worked in the Office of City Clerk, please rise to be recognized. Rise. Wave your hands. I'd also like to thank our former Mayor Emanuel's administration in December, who stepped in to say yes to this collaborative. The Department of Finance, Chicago Department of Transportation, Chicago Police Department, and Budget. Thank you for being true partners and coming to the table and helping us find some solutions to the issues. I'd also like to thank Mayor Lori Lightfoot for her support on this work. We had a meeting about 3 weeks ago, and she made it known that this was a priority, it was in her platform, and that she fully intends on working with the collaborative in the future and on the report. So I'd like to thank both of them publicly. Now, the time you've been waiting for. We'd like to share these recommendations with you today and a little bit about our work before we kick off the conversation. Our work is divided into four categories. The first, which is creating pathways to compliance. As policymakers, we should shift our assumptions and policymaking that residents want to be in compliance with the law, but need more pathways to do so. That's why we are recommending reforming city sticker tickets to reforming payment plans, a city sticker forgiveness program, to reinstating the 15-day grace period for city sticker tickets, among others. Secondly, we need to evaluate our longstanding practices. As government, it's important to be reflective of our past practices. Economic times and people's circumstances change over time, and government should change with them. Through feedback at our many roundtables and town halls, we learned that we need to conduct additional research to evaluate some of our practicing and existing systems. I'm proud to say that the University of Chicago, led by the School of Social Service Administration, will act primary academic as our academic partner in this work. Third, we need to improve access and awareness to residents on the city's policy programs and options. While consumer education alone doesn't address the root causes of the systems that need reforms, it plays an important role in raising awareness of any of the reforms that will be implemented in the coming weeks, months, and years. Yes, I said weeks. Lastly, we want to ensure that this work includes long-term reforms so that 10 years from now, we don't have to do another collaborative. We hope to make, and we will make, transformational structural changes to build equity, sustainability, and viability of long-standing reforms. You can find a full set of recommendations on our website today. Everyone's going to run over to it, I know. www.shycityclerk.com. Again, that's shycityclerk.com, starting at 9:30 a.m. Through these set of recommendations, we hope to reform and rebuild our city's collection practices, helping our residents achieve and maintain compliance. Through the implementation of these recommendations, we strive to make our city that works for all of its residents, no matter what your zip code may be. But it doesn't end here. We view these recommendations as a place to start rather than the end of this work. I want to repeat this. This is a start rather than the end of this work, a down payment, if you will, on the reforms that we hope to make. And as your city clerk, I want you to know that we are committed to making Chicago the best place to live, work, and raise a family for all of us. I am committed to you, and I'm committed to this mission. Thank you. Now let's get this party started. I would like to introduce our incredible panelists for today, Dr. Helene Gale, Dr. Damon Jones, and Ms. Rose Grillier. Dr. Helene D. Gale is the president and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, one of the nation's oldest and largest community foundations. Before coming to the trust, Dr. Gale held a variety of leadership roles in public health and global development, including with the Centers for Disease Control, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and as the president and CEO of the international humanitarian organization, CARE. She serves on several public company and nonprofit boards, including our Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago and the Economic Club of Chicago. This is really cool coming up. Named one of Forbes' 100 Most Powerful Women and one of Nonprofit Times' Power and Influence Top 50, she has authored numerous articles on public health issues, poverty alleviation, gender equality, and social justice. Dr. Gale was born and raised in Buffalo, New York. She earned her bachelor's degree from Barnard College of Columbia University, her medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania, and master's of public health from Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Gale. Dr. Damon Jones is an associate professor at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. He conducts research at the intersection of three fields within economics. Damon's current research topics include income tax policy, Social Security, retirement and retirement savings, and the interaction between employer-provided benefits and labor market outcomes. He was a postdoctoral fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research and is faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Jones received his PhD in economics from the University of California, Berkeley, and also holds a BA in public policy with a minor in African American studies from Stanford University, which he received in 2003. Professor? Now the real rock star of the group, Miss Rose Grillier, is the mother of two daughters, both currently in college, a longtime activist in her Southside Inglewood community, and co-chair of Power PAC, Parents Organize to Win, Educate, and Renew Policy Action Council, a parent-led cross-cultural organization of low-income parents based in Chicago, which is supported by community organizing and family issues, also known as COFI. Power PAC's mission is to build a strong voice for low-income immigrant and working families by uniting parents and grandparents across race and community around the issues of importance to families. Ms. Grillier is also co-chair of Power PAC's Stepping Out of Poverty campaign, which seeks to increase economic stability for low-income families, and a leader in Power PAC's Early Learning campaign. As a COFI parent peer trainer, she has traveled the country providing trainings in COFI's leadership, development, and organizing model and inspiration to hundreds of other low-income parent leaders. In 2011, Ms. Grillier was awarded Allstate's Give Back Day Award and national recognition honoring volunteers in African-American communities across the country for their efforts to make positive changes within their communities. I'm excited to have this important conversation with all these incredible people. Please join us, Ms. Rose. Okay. So, to start off, each of you occupy a different field and have a diverse range of experience from your perspective. What does economic and racial equity look like? And I'm going to start with you, Ms. Rose, on this.
So imagine if every family had the ability to live their best life, to thrive, to raise their children and provide a better for each generation. That's what it looks like to us. However, there are system barriers that prevent many families who work hard, who do all the right things, from actually achieving those goals.
Okay, thank you. And to Dr. Gale.
Yeah, not too different, but I will just back it up and say, you know, one of the things, since I've been in Chicago almost 2 years now, and looking at where we as a foundation would put our greatest focus, you know, this issue of the racial wealth divide became clear that it was really the issue that was undergirding almost everything else that we think about. And many people may have seen in the paper the article that showed this 30-year life expectancy gap between somebody who lives in Streeterville and somebody who lives in Englewood. You know, that's not about medical care. That's about equity. And if we went to the other day, the Fed had a seminar talking about the plunder of black wealth that showed that over the period of time when contract house buying and redlining combined for black communities, that $3.2 to $4 billion of wealth was extracted from the black communities. And so when you look at, and you can go on and on about the statistics, it's hard not to address this issue. And so for us, we have made that our primary purpose, our primary focus. And I think it is for the very reasons that you said, that we believe that it is the just and right thing to do, that everybody should have the opportunity to feed their children, send them to a quality school, have housing security, and on access to health services, access to proper nutrition, all of those things, so that every community is thriving, because it makes all of us better. And so for us as a city to be able to have neighborhoods that all thrive means that we will all do better. And it's right for the people who live in those neighborhoods who have been robbed of the opportunity, but it's also the thing that's going to continue to propel us further as a city.
Thank you. And Professor, to add on.
I think so. You've both put it very well and covered a lot of different ways in which equity might look. One interesting statistic that came up in a discussion I was just having last Friday was that if you look at the top, a black family in the top 1%, their son may have a probability of being incarcerated of maybe 3%. If you look at the bottom 1% of income, a white family, their son's probability of being incarcerated is only 5%. So you would think that there would be different comparison there. So when I think about equity, I think about things like mass incarceration, segregation residentially, differences in how schools, access to school, quality education, the racial wealth gap, and health disparities. I think about a lot of statistics in the line of work that I do, but I also think at a basic level that for me, equity means that the policies, the society, and people in society look at families of different backgrounds and give them all the same grace in believing that they're trying to do the same thing that you're trying to do, which is make a better way for their children, provide for their family, to be healthy, to have a meaningful life. And so I think that if that is afforded to everyone equally and sufficiently, then that would be what I would define as equity.
Okay, well, thank you. So building on top of that, now that we've kind of defined what we're talking about today, I want to start, you all have different lenses, which I love. You have the philanthropy lens, we have an academic lens, we have a community lens. And so what I want to ask to you, there's so many issues. Where do we kind of tackle first? And I want to start with you, Ms. Rose. You've been working on this work the last 3 years, and I know more than that, the fines and fees is just one piece of, you know, Kofi's kind of vision. Where do you see the biggest need to start when we tackle some of these issues? How would you prioritize that?
You're absolutely correct. We have five campaigns, actually, our Stepping Out of Poverty being one that produced the Debt Spiral Report. We also have our Early Learning and Early Education, which deals with early ed and child care. We have our Restorative Justice, our EJC, that looks at the school-to-prison pipeline, push-outs, expulsions in school. And we have our Recess in Health that looks at the food disparities and all of these things are interconnected. So I would think the one place to start is to bring the human back. These are human beings who are trying to live their best life. And it is a struggle enough to be in challenged communities. Every day is a struggle within itself. And to take the very things from those folks that would help them survive or cause them to be in a position of homelessness or in a position of being suicidal, just from basic human needs, we have to look at the systems that are causing people to experience these disparities.
All right. And I know in terms of the work that you're doing, Dr. Gale, I came to a focus group that you've had on like wealth, and you're trying to identify where to start as well. Where would you say kind of prioritizing as a city we should lead on trying to tackle these issues to create equity?
Well, first, it has to be comprehensive. There is no one magic bullet. And so what we've tried to do is we've looked at our work around closing the racial wealth gap is to think about what are the things that contribute to wealth. So asset and the ability to create assets, income, obviously, the ability to have jobs that provide a reasonable standard of living and jobs that can give a career pathway. And then the things that take away from wealth or debt. So we've really looked at, you know, kind of wealth is equal to assets plus income minus debt, and working on all three of those areas. And so, for instance, if you look at what has been the biggest wealth creator for people who had access to home loans, well, it's owning a home and owning a home in an area where you can expect to keep the value or the value will increase. That's how people, particularly white people coming back from war, had easy access to FHA loans that black people were denied. That was a vehicle for creating wealth and then having intergenerational wealth that could be passed down, et cetera. So looking at some of those sorts of things, how do you make sure that people have the kind of education that prepares them for careers and for careers that have the potential for really supporting a family? So looking at some of those issues. But I think the issue of debt is a huge one and oftentimes gets left out of it. And that's why we're so happy with this task force and fines and fees. And there's lots of ways in which debt just gets creates this vicious cycle that people can't get out of. So we'll pay attention to that. We also think that there's some cross-cutting things on this kind of the structural and policy side that can make a big difference. For instance, things like earned income tax credit. It's a vehicle that we have, but it's a vehicle that is very complicated for many people, puts a lot of restrictions, and isn't done in a way that is consistent with the way people live your life. You get one check at the end of the year. Well, we live our lives in, you know, 12 months or 2 week cycles. Could you change earned income tax so that it really is more relevant to the way people live their lives? So I think there that whole range of things, and that's why we want to do it in a comprehensive way that looks at assets, looks at income, looks at debt, but also looks at some of the policies that could be helpful to give people kind of just some basic financial security.
Thank you. Professor?
So I think that in addition to what was said, we need to think also in a city like Chicago spatially where opportunities are and how resources are allocated and where people tend to live, where people tend to work, how they're able to get around. So, for example, we want to make sure that there's good infrastructure and transportation that allows people to move around the city and get to where they need to go in order to take advantage of the resources that are here. And even better than being able to travel around the city, being able to locate and live where you would best like to live in the city. So we have in the city a history of segregation, racial segregation, and there's a lot of segregation across income as well. And so things that we can do to try to alleviate how siloed different neighborhoods are in the city might also help.
Do you have any ideas you want to add to that of how?
How to, yeah, so.
Not to put you on the spot. I mean, that's everyone's been trying to address that for, but.
Well, I think that, you know, when we look at historically how we have built public housing, it's concentrated in certain neighborhoods, and there's a lot of pushback to certain types of housing, affordable housing and developments and other neighborhoods in the city that are maybe more affluent or affluent white neighborhoods. And so thinking more creatively about how we can get more of that evenly distributed throughout the city might be.
Yeah, I would just add, you know, one of the things that always makes me hopeful is looking at young people. And we have a program called Chicago 200, which is taking young people, 200 or so young people, to look at how do they want the city of Chicago to look when it turns 200. So that's 2037. And they've been in a process of reimagining what the city will look like from their vision and what they want to contribute to. And this is young people from across the city, all, you know, all colors, all religions, you know, all social economic status. And when you see these young people together, you know, this is how you start breaking down bridges. We've got to figure out ways to have our communities interact so that people know each other. And then I think people are more likely to care about what's happening to somebody in a part of the city that you don't live in, because that's a real person. So I think there's lots of ways in which we can think about how do we mix it up. I love what Jamal Cole is doing with My Block, My City, My Hood.
Are you going to start running with them? You know, I might. After the sprain.
I might. Yeah, and as long as it's not in the cold weather. But, you know, to bring young men who live blocks from the lake and who have never been there, and to start having everybody have the opportunity to experience this great city, and for other people to go and learn about parts of the city that, you know, we kind of condemn, but there's incredible stuff happening. I was just in Inglewood at Sweetwater Foundation. I mean, they are doing an incredible job of recreating blocks there and building back. So there's just so much going on here that I think people don't know, because we do stay in our silos. And the more we can bust that up and get people understanding the beauty of the city, I think we're going to get further.
I love that.
Can I chime in on that?
Yeah, I was going to come to you.
I want to say I have a philosophy that says nothing about us without us.
Exactly.
Which means that One of the things that has to happen is we have to stop making decisions about communities, and we have to listen and build relationships with the folks in the community. No one knows or knew how to raise my children better than I did. Even when I was dying from stage 4 cancer, there was still not a better mother for my children than me. And so no decisions could be made about them without me. And oftentimes we think that we know what's best for a community, and we come in with all of these plans and we waste money. Because if you don't have the community voice there, it's not going to work. But if we can work together, and this is why you are my Shiro, if we can come together and listen to each other and build those relationships, imminent is success.
Yeah. Oh, I feel like we're preaching today. I love it. So I want to go back to you, Dr. Jones, and I want to ask you a little bit about your work. So aside from what was explored in the recent ProPublica report, is there evidence from the social sciences on the potential effects of fines and fees for economically vulnerable populations?
I think there's a recent study that was released by a researcher's name is Stephen Mello. He's an economist that's going to be at Dartmouth. And so he had an interesting study. It was called Speed Trap or Poverty Trap. And in his study, he looked in Florida. That's where he had the data. And he's able to look at all like tickets, traffic tickets in the state of Florida, and link them to people's credit reports and payroll data to see how it affects your financial health and whether you work or not. And what he found was that on average, a ticket that on average would be about $175 had the same adverse impacts as $950 drop in your salary, your earnings, or your income. So what he found is that a small fine could multiply itself through many avenues. He found increases in people's collections, and these weren't collections for the tickets. These were collections for other types of debts. So, you know, it could cause a domino effect. People were slightly less likely to be found working. And this was particularly the case for those in the bottom 25% of the income group in Florida. So that was an interesting study because the way the research was designed, you were able to establish a causal link from getting a ticket to subsequently looking at how your finances evolve and how your income and your employment situation evolves. And so I think that just kind of underscores the importance of thinking how to avoid this type of spiraling effect of these fees and tickets.
Thank you. So before I get to our questions, I have one last question for the panel, and then I'm going to get to our audience questions. So last week, Ms. Rose and I had the opportunity to go to Minneapolis together, and we sat on a panel together to discuss the work on fines and fees. Ms. Rose was the rock star signing autographs at the end. But she makes a really good point about community-led initiatives and making sure that even on panels like this, that we recognize there's so much great information and resources in the community that need to shine as well. So we need to be intentional when we're creating these panels to make sure that voice is part of it. So I want to talk... Ms. Rose, I know, learned from a lot of other cities last week at this conference. But what, to all three of you, what cities can Chicago take inspiration from? Which cities have been models at closing the wealth gap and promoting economic and racial equity? I know not every city is perfect, and Chicago has its own unique challenges in other cities. But have you seen other cities that have been thriving or maybe doing something that we should catch on to?
Yeah, so
Ms. Rose, you want to go first?
So absolutely. Well, you know, we took a page from San Francisco and we looked at other cities who were working on these same kind of initiatives as we were doing the collecting information for our report and the debt spiral. And we actually met with the treasurer of San Francisco to help inform some of our recommendations. And at this actual conference, they had a panel on young mayors who has some really innovative ideas and things that they've been implementing in their city. And what I think of that, nobody's Chicago. Chicago is different. We have a lot of things that move in different ways in other cities, but it doesn't mean that we can't take best practices and figure out how it could work well for Chicago and not just say, well, they're not Chicago. Well, that's not the point. The point is we need to make sure that our city is the greatest. And how can you be great when your weakest link is still weak? And so we have to find ways to take the best practices, the innovative practices that are happening across this country, and then implement them in Chicago in a way that works in Chicago. It's simple.
And I think on the San Francisco Treasurer on that panel with us, who led the work 2 years ago, talked about they're now tackling library fines and library fees to eliminate that, to allow more people to use the libraries that were really targeted for. And they have some park fees in other cities that they're also eliminating. So there's some interesting work happening there, too. Do you want to go?
Oh, sure. So in terms of cities, I'd like to piggyback off of the statement about cities that may not be exactly like Chicago, but we may still learn from. So another city in California that I'd give a shout out to is Stockton, California. They have a very young mayor, Michael Tubbs. And so I think that that city might be a city that we can look to for some inspiration. They have a lot of innovative policies that they're using to try to tackle some, you know, like persistent issues that they've faced with in terms of poverty and mobility, economic mobility, and things like that. So Stockton, California, I would just say keep your eyes peeled for what they're doing over there.
Yeah, and, you know, as we've all said, there is no one silver bullet. So I think there's a lot of different innovations that we're beginning to see in a variety of cities. You mentioned Stockton. One of the things that they have been piloting is a universal basic income that guarantees everybody a certain amount of cash. And, you know, throughout the world, this issue of cash transfers has shown how important it can be to provide some financial stability. So they're the first major city in the United States that it's actually piloting it. And that was one of the recommendations that came out of the Resilience Task Force that we were on, is to look at potentially a pilot for a universal basic income. So I think that has, you know, that has some validity, and we'll see what Stockton shows. You know, California, you mentioned San Francisco. One of the things that I think they've done very interestingly is to develop this public bank. And it basically is a bank that has vehicles that are very easy to use for people who are unbanked. And it's been a way of getting around a lot of the predatory lending that goes on. So I think, you know, things that look at, can we help communities to not have to go to sources of loans that only put them further in debt because of, you know, 400-500% interest, et cetera. Detroit, I think, has done a lot post their real crisis around small business entrepreneurship and some of the collaboratives that they have that are working to get capital to small businesses in communities where there's not been investment. And I think they've done some really interesting things. And just finally, there was a panel that Arne Duncan did, oh, maybe 3 or 4 months ago, brought many of the mayors who had some success in reducing the violence. And, you know, all of them had different reasons and different ways of tackling it. But one of the biggest ones was that they had much higher rates of solved homicide crimes. And if we looked at our rate of crimes, solving crimes and look at theirs, they had actually done a much better job of solving killings and homicides than we had, as well as, you know, a much better job of community policing. So I think there's, you know, I think from across the country there are nuggets of things. One other one, because it's my hometown, Buffalo. We just visited the Buffalo Community Foundation, and they have made racial equity the core of their work and have developed a a citywide roundtable where all the different segments of society have these roundtables to address the issue of racial equity, still starting, still early, but to have that kind of a citywide dialogue about what does it mean to be a racially equitable city is pretty impressive. The mayor is involved, the businesses are involved, the nonprofits, community leaders, et cetera. So I think there's some good things going on around that we could learn from.
Awesome. Thank you. I know I want to make sure there's time for questions for the audience. So there'll be some questions. If you have a question that you would like to submit, they'll walk around and you can have time to write your question. I want to dig back into something you were all talking about, and I thought it was a good topic that sometimes we don't discuss enough about what's happening. How do we get people to see what the good is happening in Chicago? Because there is a lot of nonprofits, community organizations, a lot of things happening on the ground level that don't always get in the media. And so this question is from Carolyn O, Chicago Booth School of Business. People don't truly understand what it will take to create equity in our city. How can we really get people to understand and accept that they will need to share in the suffering, so to speak? So I know Mayor Lightfoot talks a lot about everyone getting involved and what's happening in the city. What are ways that you think we can do that?
So I'll just say, walk in my shoes. And again, so I'm a proud, I live in Englewood, actually, and there are amazing things. And I think when we support the good thing, you never hear it reported on the news, but there are a couple of young men who actually took our trainings, and one of their goals was to have a barbershop that was a hub for the community where old and young could come together, share experiences, mentor back and forth, you know, have that dialogue that would bring healing to violence, develop those relationships that could help heal the community. And other amazing things are happening in Englewood, but you never hear it reported. You never hear those stories about the older guy that is 96 at this point who goes around and cleans the whole community. You never hear those stories, but as soon as somebody's shot, you know, it's on the news for 3 days, or if Jussie Smollett told a lie, you hear about that the rest
forever.
Of your life. So, I mean, we have to change the narrative around how we really view things and celebrate and build up as opposed to tearing down. How can you build a beautiful city if you keep tearing down parts of it? It's going to be an eyesore. And so I just wanted to share that.
So changing the narrative. I think that's so important. I love that. Dr. Jones or Dr. Yale?
One thing I'd say is just the framing. I would think about the framing differently. So the question was framed as, you know, everyone will have to share in the suffering, but, you know, we definitely want to change the framing to everybody can share in the prosperity that can happen if we have a healthy city uniformly throughout all the different neighborhoods. So I would change the framing of that. And then in terms of, we talked about changing the narrative. I think something that usually maybe underappreciated is, as we were talking about with the youth and how what their vision is for the future, to think about how they can best express that. And one of the main avenues for that is through art and artistic expression. And so that's usually a very important part of having a vision and imagination for a different future is supporting the arts and letting art play a role in how you create a new picture.
Yeah, I'm ditto on this suffering thing. I just think people, when we start talking about this, get gloomy, and you know, this is hard, and you know, we're all going to have to, you know, suffer, take a step back, or whatever. This is the most hopeful vision I think that there could be. Imagine that you go into every neighborhood in this city and it's thriving and you see young people playing in the streets and they feel safe and they've got schools to go to and, you know, there's grocery stores. And, you know, so I think this is really a hopeful vision and one where, yeah, maybe there may be need to be some shifts in how we spend our funds and who is prioritized. But I don't think that this has to be a downer for folks. So, that's number one. I think that it can be incredibly hopeful. I do think, though, and it's part of why, again, what you're doing is so important, Anna, is that this has to, there's a lot we can do with programs, but at the end of the day, it's policies that are going to change this. Policies, bad public policy got us to where we are today, and it's only by having good public policy that we're going to make the kinds of changes, systemic changes, that are really going to make a difference. So while there's lots that we can do to fund good groups and to get resources into communities, we also have to think about the policies, and it's again why the nothing for us without us, we've got to have people sitting at policy tables who are thinking about their lived experiences and what the consequences of our policy decisions. Some of the policies that got us here were just wrongheaded, and they were probably deliberately meant to do what they did do. Exactly. But there are other policies that oftentimes are put in place because the lens by which somebody is thinking about them doesn't take into consideration somebody else's life reality. They didn't do it to be evil. They just had no idea what the long-term consequences are. So we've got to make sure that we're at the table and looking at those policies, because it's systems change that's going to make the biggest difference.
I love that. Thank you. Clap on that. That was good. And I think to add to that, one of the beautiful things that we got to see during this collaboration was that you actually had department heads hearing directly from community residents. And at times, those conversations were emotionally charged. But what was great is that you finally had, to what Ms. Rose said, you had department heads not just worrying about the revenue, but looking at the people that it was affecting and seeing people as human beings. And I think also, not to speak for Ms. Rose, I think Ms. Rose also saw the human beings on the city side, that they could see each other as humans working towards a solution. So I love that piece when you're talking about making policies with communities. Talking a little bit about economic development, I got this question from Ben Bornstein. From education to living wage, jobs are often cited as key factors to sustainable wealth. Opportunity zones are a federally backed investment program to spur economic growth in low-income areas. What is the state of such capital in Chicago? And I chose this question selfishly because we're working with the trust. Dr. Gale had a meeting on opportunity zones, just information meeting in February, and 500 people showed up to hear about it. But often economic development has happened not community-led, but actually developers kind of going in. The trust has tried to change that with it being community-led process, and we actually had a meeting last Friday in the IMD at Malcolm X with community stakeholders, with foundations, with community activists, and also with some out-of-town folks like the mayor of Birmingham's team and others that are doing this work in other cities. But Dr. Gale and Dr. Jones, would you like to talk a little bit about, could this be a tool to also spur economic development?
Yeah, I think it could be a huge tool. But to your point, I think unless we make sure that it involves communities, it involves people who have longstanding relationship with communities, it could very well be a great tax incentive for people to come in and do real estate development that the community won't benefit from. So I think it has that potential to be huge. I think it's one of the most, again, kind of optimistic policy levers that has happened in a long time. But we've got to be there to make sure that it has the intended benefit for the communities themselves.
I would just add that you have to be, I guess, vigilant with these types of opportunity zone tax policies, because the most recent round of like opportunity zone policy, there are some questions about how you can qualify for these and how much you have to do for the local community to qualify for them. And so you can have a fund where, people are investing in your fund and you're located in the neighborhood and receive special tax treatment. But you really need to ensure that there are like requirements on, you know, who's employed by your organization and what type of activities you're engaged in to actually have that benefit spill over to the community. So you just want to be mindful about potential gaming of those tax write-offs, because, you know, we were talking about the intention of policies. And so, you know, you just want to be sure that there's not a way for someone to exploit that type of tax incentive.
Awesome. So I know we could spend all day up here. I feel like Oprah Super Soul Sunday podcast. So I want to just leave. I always like to leave on a positive note to set our day. As you all have purpose and you're driven with kind of your intention of your work, I love the word reimagine Chicago, what the future could be. So if you could see Chicago 200 years from now, to your point, Dr. Gale, and what the youth are coming up with, what would you reimagine Chicago to be? What is your vision and your dream for Chicago? I'll start with Ms. Rose.
Wow. So I have an automatic vision, and that is that I'm going to be a part of changing everything worldwide. So, but that's my own personal task. I believe that's why he allowed me to survive stage 4 cancer, for that purpose. But outside of that, I want to see a city where we are working together in a way that there's no us and them and you and us, that we are Chicago, that all the communities have the opportunities they deserve to have, that everyone, I think about statewide, we're working on the License to Work Act. I want to see a city where a person can go to work because you didn't take their car. They could get a job that they're qualified for because they have their license, not because they didn't make a child support payment when they're probably already actually taking care of their children. I just want to see a city where people are allowed to be their best. And my philosophy about it all is it's accountable to all of us, because the truth of the matter is, at the end of the day, either we're a part of the solution or we're a part of the problem.
Dr. Gale?
Yeah, hard to top that. I mean, I really, you know, it's the same vision. I want to be able to go anywhere in this city and it's thriving, and that there are opportunities, and that nobody, and, you know, nobody maybe is a strong word. There will always be some inequity and there'll be always some challenges. But that generally, this is a city where people feel like if they want to do it, it's possible. And, you know, I also want to see a population that is growing, because I think a population that, you know, we have people leaving this city in, you know, in droves, and it's disproportionately African-Americans. I'd like to see a city where people feel like they want to come to this city because it's the best city, and that young people, you know, come here to school and they stay here because there's so much opportunity here. So, you know, that's kind of what I would like to see. And if it's okay, I just want to put in one plug, because there may be some people who are interested. We just released a call for proposals for a project for entrepreneurs of color. And it's a partnership between ourselves, J.P. Morgan Chase, the Coleman Foundation, the McCormick Foundation. So go on our website if you're interested. And this is to really help build the systems and the support for entrepreneurs of color.
I love that. I meant to plug that earlier, but I am so excited for that. I think that when you go around the communities, that's something they're really looking for, is that capital. So thank you for doing that.
And we're going to do more of it.
Dr. Jones?
Some of the things I'd like to see have already been said. So the first thing that came to mind was that in 200 years, I hope the city is still here, that the water hasn't risen from the lake to cover us. So, you know, I'd like the climate to be intact. And then beyond that, I think that you can look at certain cities and, you know, you can see where we might be headed. There are certain cities with very stark inequality and basically very wealthy people and a lot of homeless people. I won't name any names, but, you know, you don't want to see like that post sort of apocalyptic landscape in your city. And so I think that we need to, you know, before it's too late, try to steer us in a different direction where there's a more evenly spread growth, including who we're hemorrhaging, what types of communities we're hemorrhaging from the city, having them be retained. And so I guess that was what I didn't want to see. So what I guess what I do want to see is an even amount of prosperity across the neighborhoods, and also you know, a reckoning with what we've done in the past to get us to this place, so that we can move forward.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time today and for sharing your wisdom today. I'm super excited, and thank you for being here to support the work of this very first step that we're doing on our fines and fees, and enjoy your day today. Thank you so much for coming out this morning.